Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Austerity schmerity. There's always room for vacation, says Europe. Tijuana versus Shenzhen, a battle over high-tech manufacturing jobs. And why all the hoopla over Hulu? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, May 27th. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day. The markets are taking the day off here in the U.S., and millions of Americans are doing the same. If you spent the holiday binge-watching Arrested Development on Netflix or watching some network TV series on Hulu, yeah, we know, it's tempting. A lot of us are watching TV from our laps these days, and that's why an outfit like Hulu is getting all sorts of love, the corporate kind, that is. Yahoo is making a bid for Hulu just days after finalizing its purchase of the blogging platform Tumblr. Yahoo's reportedly prepared to pay between $600 and $800 million for the video streaming service, and it's only one of several suitors, all of whom are willing to pay big bucks. Marketplace's Noel King looks at why Hulu is such a hot commodity.
Why does Yahoo think Hulu is worth hundreds of millions of dollars? Here's the first reason.
The following program is brought to you with limited commercial interruption by your local Dodge dealer.
It's as simple as advertising dollars. Yahoo isn't the only company looking to acquire Hulu. Time Warner Cable, DirecTV, and a handful of private equity firms are also reportedly interested. Media analyst Jack Myers says they're all counting on the same thing.
In just the next 2 years, advertisers will invest an estimated $8.5 billion in online video advertising.
And a lot of that $8.5 billion will go to Hulu, because the site owns licensing rights to a lot of really popular shows. Everything from The Daily Show and Modern Family to...
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Tech analyst Roger Kay says Yahoo's interest in Hulu is pretty simple. If the internet giant wants to be a contender...
Yahoo needs a video platform. Google and Amazon both have well-developed video platforms, and Yahoo is in need of beefing up its content across the board, and video is a particularly important content type.
Hulu's growing subscription service is also a huge draw, says James McQuivy. He's an analyst at Forrester Research. Right now, 4 million people shell out $8 a month to get more Hulu on more devices.
Before, when we all watched Hulu on our computers, and it was fun to catch a little bit of Saturday Night Live or something, we didn't pay for it. Now we have our tablets and our smartphones. The only way to really get good Hulu on those devices is to be a Hulu Plus subscriber.
Analysts say they expect that subscriber base will only grow. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
And now let's go to a company that is not the object of anybody's corporate desires right now. The Israeli company Better Place is liquidating. Better Place had an idea for electric cars with batteries you could swap in and out. Trade in an empty one for one with juice, just like that. It started as a very cool idea, but the vehicles got an even cooler reception from customers. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Better Place came and went, even though a lot of Americans never heard of it. But in small countries like Israel and Denmark, the company stoked a lot of excitement with a kind of propane gas tank model. Swapping stations are where drivers can get new electric car batteries on the run. But here's the problem. Electric vehicles are pricey, so there aren't many swappers. Sandeep Kaur is with the consultancy Frost & Sullivan.
The environmental stewardship value proposition hits the heart, but I believe the sticker shock hits the wallet harder. And that's what was the issue that really brought this company down.
It didn't help that old-school fossil fuel cars got cheaper to own as crude oil prices softened in the recession. Better Place was founded by Shai Agassi, a former software executive known for his boldness. But perhaps he was too brash. Here's clean tech entrepreneur and investor Jigar Shah.
You can't really go to somebody in the auto business and say, I'm going to decimate your business model. And you can imagine a lot of automakers don't take kindly to people telling them how their cars should work.
It's not just the big automakers. Big oil is hard to nudge, too. Yes, electric car maker Tesla is growing, but lots of upstarts go under. Seth Fletcher is the author of a book on the electric battery. It's called Bottled Lightning.
This is more the norm than the exception. These are really bold, risky ideas, and most of them are going to fail. But, you know, that's what venture capitalists expect from their investments.
As for electric vehicle skeptics, they're having a field day with the demise of Better Place and of soft sales of electric vehicles in general. And now there's a new rival. Cheap natural gas can power cars, too. To which Jigarshaw gives the entrepreneur response. The cup is half full.
People mocked flat screen televisions, right? People mock change, and that's okay because, you know, they're not my first customer.
He predicts the next generation of startups will take up the innovative ideas from Better Place and perhaps execute them better. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed for Memorial Day. We'll have other market details when we do the numbers. So Memorial Day comes around, and what happens? Well, we all start dreaming of summer, of course, especially the idea of a vacation. On that subject, let's just admit it. We Americans are always a little jealous of our friends over in Europe, where vacations are actually mandated, which makes it a good time to ask.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? Martina Stevis is here to answer that question for us today. She covers European economics for Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. Born and raised in Greece, but she's based in Brussels. Martina, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So, listen, a report came out this week in the United States that estimated that almost a quarter of Americans get no vacation time at all. Just for comparison's sake, what do most Europeans get when it comes to time off in the summer?
Well, I think on average you would get around 25 days in a year. Things are really, really quiet over the summer in Europe as well. August tends to be a really unproductive month. So people do tend to take a couple of weeks off over August and then spread the rest of the holiday time, around Easter time or other religious holidays and Christmas time or so.
Is that changing at all, though? Is there any temptation on the part of some of these European countries to cut back on mandated vacation time, given that the economy is doing so poorly, that you've got these government austerity measures in place? Has anybody decided we can't afford this anymore?
Actually, not really. I think the point people are trying to make here in Europe is that if you're not rested and if you haven't had some proper time with your family and some time to unwind, this is actually going to catch up with the quality of your work.
Tell Americans that, right? Talk about your home country, though, Greece, where the jobless rate right now is, what, about 27%? Is that right?
That's right. And it's about 60% for youth.
Yeah.
So for guys up to girls up to 24 years of age, yeah.
How can anybody afford a vacation with that going on?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The good thing the Greeks have going for them is that they actually live in a beautiful country that happens to be a top tourist destination.
Right.
And I think Greeks do tend to stay in Greece for their holidays.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when everyone else is coming to your country for a holiday, why would you choose to leave?
To escape the obnoxious tourists, for one. But yeah. I read the other day that Greece is really banking on a busy tourist season to help boost its economy. How important is it to Greece that they really reel in tourists this summer?
Oh, it's crucial. It's very important. It's not to say that, you know, the Greek economy depends 100% on tourism. It doesn't, of course.
Yeah.
But it would be such a big breather and such a big psychological factor as well as a matter of survival for those tourist businesses to have a good summer this year. The early signs as we go into the fully fledged kind of summer season, which is the high season for Greece, kind of June to September sort of thing, are good. There's signs of increased pre-bookings from Northern Europe. So I think they are very hopeful. And it is really important, even psychologically, to see a boost this year. But also, you know, not everyone has a massive hotel. There are some very small businesses, small hotels, small restaurants, family-owned normally on the islands, that are really struggling to survive, and those tend to be the most beautiful ones. So these guys really, really depend on this season especially.
So I've got to ask you, what about your own vacation plans? Do you stay in Europe or do you go elsewhere?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because I am due to be inside the beautiful Greek sea in approximately 27 days from now.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yep. Countdown has formally started. And then I'm going to take some time off in August again, and I'll be going back home to Greece. My parents were very lucky, are from the islands. So at very little cost, I can pick and choose between the two different islands that they're from and go see them.
Now, I know you're not a travel guide, but do us a favor here. Americans, when they go to Europe, they seem to go to all the same places. You know, they like to go to Italy, they go to Spain, maybe they take that trip to Paris or London. If I'm an American on a limited budget and I want to go somewhere in Europe where not a lot of other tourists are going, do you have any advice?
Well, if you're looking to avoid tourists, I guess I wouldn't recommend Greece, although prices are cheaper this year. There's some very good options a little further north. For example, in Croatia.
Croatia.
The sea is beautiful and the coastline is beautiful. And it would be a very nice way to say welcome to the Croatians, who will become the 28th member of the European Union as of July 1st this year.
Aha. Uh-huh. Martina Stevas covers the European economy for Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. Martina, thanks a lot.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
The feds have a new weather forecast for the coming summer. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration does that kind of thing, and here's the bad news. There's not a lot of rain on the horizon for most of the country, which means last year's drought isn't going away. Commentator Robert Glennon says that spells trouble for our groundwater supply.
The U.S. is suffering through the worst drought since the 1950s. It's especially hurt farmers, who are desperately searching for new sources of water. And they think they've found the perfect solution. It's groundwater stored in aquifers. The temptation to use this water is irresistible. It's practically everywhere, and it's mostly unregulated. The problem is, it's also finite. Think of an aquifer as a giant milkshake glass, and each well is a straw in the glass. Most states allow an unlimited number of straws. This situation is sustainable only if the amount of water sucked out doesn't exceed the amount that is replenished by rainwater. But the laws governing groundwater are encouraging a race to the bottom of the glass. Many states follow what is called the reasonable use doctrine. This allows landowners to pump an unlimited amount of water for whatever they deem a beneficial use. It used to be that only Western farmers pumped groundwater to irrigate crops. Now it's happening across the country. The cumulative effect of this change has profound implications for the country's water supplies, because irrigation uses more water than anything else. States are struggling to find water for farms, for cities, and for industry, and they should establish sensible restrictions on drilling new wells and on how much can be taken from existing ones. Defenders of unrestricted groundwater pumping insist that landowners have a property right to the groundwater beneath their land. But adjoining landowners share the same right. Unlimited pumping is like a circular firing squad. It guarantees mutually assured destruction, or in this case, mutually assured depletion of a precious resource.
Robert Glennon is a Regents Professor at the University of Arizona College of Law. He's also author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Coming up, a new economic rival emerges.
The wages in China are more than they were before. That's one thing. Then China is 6 weeks away from the most important market, which is U.S.
Find out which country is stealing business from China. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street is shuttered today in observance of Memorial Day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rests at 15,303. The Nasdaq's at 3,459. The S&P 500 will start tomorrow's trading at 1,649. Paris's CAC 40 and Germany's DAX each gained nearly 1% today. London's FTSE was closed for a bank holiday. Japan's Nikkei took another hit today, losing 3.25%. Investors aren't sure if the Japanese central bank has an answer for deflation. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. We'll find out how many got a shiny gift in a little blue box. Tiffany & Company reports earnings. Way back in 1937, Volkswagen was founded in Germany. And it's the start of the National Spelling Bee. I'm B-R-I-D-G-E-T Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Ristall. It's a good time to be a recruiter for the U.S. military. Applications are up as youth unemployment soars. So the Pentagon doesn't need as many young people as it did at the height of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that means it's harder to enlist. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
6 years ago, the military needed all the people it could get as it fought two big wars. Standards were lower. You didn't have to have a high school diploma. In fact, in 2007, only 79% of new Army recruits were high school graduates. Recruiters took just about everyone who walked in their door. Army Sergeant Richard Guzman remembers those days.
I started my recruiting duty in New York City back in 2005.
Back then, it was pretty common for the Army to grant waivers excusing past misconduct, even felonies. The recruiters request the waivers when they come across a recruit who seems promising but has a record. Sergeant Guzman says in 2005...
Like, every waiver was approved. I don't think I've never had a waiver disapprove. I mean, you know, I processed just, you know, applicants with, you know, possession waivers, rape, assault, felonies, drugs.
Sergeant Guzman is still requesting waivers, but now he's lucky to get 10% approved. If recruits have any blemishes on their records, let alone a felony, they're out of luck. And about 96% of the Army's new recruits in fiscal 2012 had high school diplomas.
Can't hear you.
Sergeant Guzman doesn't work in New York anymore. Now he heads the Army recruiting office in Silver Spring, Maryland. He says just look at the caliber of his latest recruits. There are six of them here at an orientation class, sitting in a circle, introducing themselves.
Hey, everybody. I'm Paul Driscoll.
Army recruit Paul Driscoll is 22. He graduated from high school in 2008, and he even has a few years of college under his belt. He says he always wanted to join the military, but he was surprised at how hard it was.
I had to do a lot of tests, physical tests and mental stuff. You know, checking out and make sure you're okay in the head. So much stuff that it was... It gets overwhelming sometimes.
Yes, the military is getting more picky. It doesn't have as many slots to fill, but also the youth unemployment rate is sky high. Michael Saltzman is research director at the Employment Policies Institute.
The teen unemployment rate has been above 20% for about 4.5 years now, which is basically something we've never seen before for young adults.
And even if these young adults land a job, they may not get benefits, which makes a military career with health insurance, a housing allowance, and money for college even more tempting. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So while we're on this theme of youth and jobs, I saw a graduation card this past weekend that said something like, "Congratulations, graduate, the sky's the limit." That's a nice sentiment, perhaps, but in today's job market, a lot of 21-year-olds would read that and say, yeah, right. So just how far can a good education take you these days? And is it really the answer to the jobs problem in this country? Jeff Madrick writes about jobs and the limits of free markets when it comes to creating good ones. It's in the latest edition of Harper's Magazine. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with you.
So, Jeff, this is graduation season, as we know, and a lot of young people are entering the job market, a very weak job market. What should they expect? Any advice?
Well, I would prepare to look very hard for a job and not blame yourself if you don't get one. The employment-to-population ratio of 20 to 24-year-olds has plummeted compared to what it used to be and has not risen in this economic recovery. This is a place where government should be moving in, I think, in providing subsidies for these young people, even maybe in providing jobs outright. When young people don't get jobs, we set ourselves up for an explosive situation down the road. Their future performance as citizens, as breadwinners, as household formers is deeply affected by the kinds of jobs they get as very young people.
But given the political atmosphere right now, you're calling for the government to subsidize job creation like that. What are the chances?
You know, I can't talk about political chances anymore. I talk about what I think has to be done. If we only talked about what this Congress could do, we may as well not talk about anything. I think the government can do many things very well and can do things we need for economic growth in a decent and fair and optimistic society again. Opportunities are not spread naturally by an economy like ours alone.
Jeff, name one thing that we are not talking about right now or not doing as a country that we could be doing to address the quality of jobs that we're creating right now.
This will surprise you. Child poverty. Our problem is not education. It's access to education from the very beginning. We have the highest child poverty rate in the rich world. When children are very poor, they don't get the physical nourishment or the educational nourishment or the emotional nourishment they need to go on, move up, and eventually become productive.
Jeff, you work in New York City. What do you see happening there? Are young people getting good jobs? Is it still a city of opportunity for young people?
You know, it's kind of interesting. My wife and I have a house in Harlem. We live in a part of Harlem that's highly Hispanic. A higher proportion of Latinos, Hispanics in New York City have jobs, even without a college education, than white people with college education have jobs. Now, these people are not making what CEOs make, but they're working and they're working hard. That's one personal experience I don't think you'll hear that much about.
Jeff Madrick, he writes the Anti-Economist column for Harper's, and his latest book is The Age of Greed. Mr. Madrick, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
Mexico's economy has been rebounding the last few years, but the latest numbers show that the country's annual growth is slowing down a bit. They can blame the U.S. in part. We're buying less from Mexico these days. Now, that could soon change as the American economy slowly improves. Plus, there's this. A report from the Boston Consulting Group says the average cost for a unit of labor is now lower in Mexico than in China. And that means companies are now relocating from China to set up shop in Mexico. The BBC's Alistair Leithet has been to Tijuana, where that shift is already in motion.
Apparently, there's a lot to be excited about in Tijuana, especially among soccer fans. Their team just won the Mexican League, only 6 years after being created. They came from nowhere and are now big players in Latin America. There's obviously something in the Mexican air. A miniature drone with six little rotors hovering over the factory floor at 3D Robotics Tijuana plant. The high-tech flying robot company was founded by ex-Wired CEO turned Silicon Valley entrepreneur Chris Anderson and a Mexican computer whiz kid he met online. They're expanding, and like other US-facing companies, are turning to Mexico's well-educated young workforce rather than China's high-tech hub.
20 years ago, Mexico was about cheap labor. Today, it's about highly skilled labor that's cost competitive with Shenzhen. And then when you net in all those external costs, the time, the shipping costs, you know, then they start to become very similar. But from an innovation perspective, working with China was slowing us down.
It's not just startups. Big manufacturers are moving more production to Mexico. DJO Global makes medical supplies like knee braces and neck supports.
We are migrating all the production that we had in China. Now we're bringing it here.
Armando Vega Gardonio is director of manufacturing at the Tijuana plant.
Now the wages in China are more than they were before. That's one thing. Then China is 6 weeks away from the most important market, which is U.S.
But what about the drug wars? The police chief still needs 10 bodyguards, but Mayor Carlos Bustamante says Tijuana is now safer than it was 2 years ago.
The perception has lingered, but we're down in murders, 70% more.
And the team taking on a Brazilian team in the Latin American Champions League. Mexico exports as many manufactured goods now as the whole of Latin America combined, and it's growing twice as fast as Brazil. But for now, at least, they had to settle for a draw. In Tijuana, I'm the BBC's Alistair Leithhead for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, what is a vintage Apple computer worth? Well, that question was answered by the German auction house Breaker over the weekend. A 1976 Apple I sold for a record $668,000. The computer sold for only $666 back in the 70s. It was made in the family garage by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. And it's actually signed by Wozniak. It works, apparently. Well, for 1976, it works. But the auctioneers say the machine's real appeal is as a symbol of the American dream. Two dropouts with a superb idea, they said. And now their idea is one of the richest companies in the world. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Du, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Julie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Sarah Gardner. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.